It's the Gauteng Johannesburg show today. Gauteng Premier Panyaza Letsufi reshuffles top team after billions go unspent, but critics are calling it nothing more than musical chairs. Johannesburg faces a financial crisis, billions in irregular spending with a tight deadline to fix, 100 days to go to the G20, and pressure mounts for Johannesburg to get ready for world leaders. Uber releases latest numbers, and Gayton McKenzie is slammed by political analyst Papano Pasha. It's Thursday, the 7th of August, and this is your BizNews briefing. I'm Bronwyn Nielsen. When we look at the headlines at the moment, Gauteng Premier Panyaza Letsufi is all over them. He just did a big shake-up. He's moved a bunch of department heads around because they weren't performing well. We're talking about 1.3 billion rand not being spent, missed targets and some really bad audit results. He's released more forensic reports, and while some people are not fans of just moving people around instead of actually firing them, Letsufi says this is the first real action against underperformers. And right now, he says six top jobs are open, and he promises that they will be filled by people who can actually do their jobs.
The movement of HODs, to me, it was very important. It has never happened before. It's the first time in the history of this province that en masse we removed HODs on the basis of non-performance, also on the basis of underperformance in terms of expenditure. And if we are going to have almost four departments that I'm speaking to you now that were refilling their post, and those HODs have been moved because the processes in government. I wish it was like politicians who can just say we have reshuffled to go home. Those that are in administration, there are processes. And we don't want to lose money or lose cases on the basis of recklessness because we are excited, we just want to remove people. The HOD has been assigned that task to work on it, and I think it's been dealing with it. But we are bringing two new sets of HODs. We're bringing young HODs and are also bringing women to assist us to also deal with these issues. And you'll see, when we fill those that are vacant, that will be in position to attend. But they've done it. And that's very important. And that's the starting point. The problem with critics, if you don't do it, you are damned. Do it, you are damned. So we are consistent. We've identified gaps. We identified limitations. And we're attending to those gaps and those limitations.
But the DA isn't buying it. They're calling Letsufi's reshuffle just a PR stunt, and they say it's a way to cover up bigger problems. According to DA Chief Whip Mike Moriarty, some of these officials have been accused of misconduct and are just moving to new roles instead of actually being held accountable. Plus, he says Letsufi hasn't acted on those lifestyle audits and the investigation reports are very redacted. The DA wants to take this up with the information regulator, and maybe even the courts pushing for more transparency and what they say is real change. Things are also not looking great in Johannesburg financially. The finance minister has sent a pretty stern letter to the mayor, basically saying, you've got 14 days to explain how to fix this mess. There's over 22 billion in irregular spending, and if the city doesn't get its act together, then it could lose a big chunk of funding. And that would mean serious trouble for basic services. Letsufi says they've already started working on it, but it is a race against time.
In terms of Johannesburg, I had a discussion with the executive mayor this morning on the basis of the letter that is received from the minister, Godongwane, on the state of finances of Johannesburg. And the executive mayor is very clear. With the bomb squad that is established and the presidential team that has been assigned to assist us here, all these issues that are identified are issues that already they've moved on them. They've attended to them. It's just that the letter came on the basis that what they are seeing as the last reports that they've received. But in between the period in which this letter was written and what they've done as the municipality, there have been meaningful progress. And I've requested him to give me that report before we send it to the minister, and is committed to give us that report. So there's a primary report he provided this morning. So In terms of Johannesburg, indeed, there are challenges. It's a huge municipality. There have been areas that people feel that we need to accelerate. But I can assure you, the presidential turnaround team has literally camped in our province. And we are quite convinced that there will be meaningful changes as we deal with it.
Talking about racing against time, there are just 100 days left before the G20. And the Gauteng provincial government is, as you've heard from Lesufi, ramping things up to make sure that Johannesburg is ready to roll out the red carpet for leaders from the world's top economies. Lesufi says he's feeling good about the city's chances of pulling off the G20 summit in November, even though there are still some headaches like broken traffic lights, potholes, crumbling buildings and street crime.
But those that are in Johannesburg, they will tell you. The M2 between Midrand and Sandton, it was a dark city, the main road. The lights are there in the evening. If you come from OR Tambo, R24, the lights are back. If you check the grass cutting, we've almost 70% started to work that thing. My only limitation, and I've emphasized it to the mayors, I don't want to do this thing for G20. I'm doing it for the citizens of Gauteng. It's just that we are hosting this important activity. We must go beyond the G20 itself and sustain this kind of work. So there will be potholes there and there, and there will be areas where people believe that we have not touched their areas. It's natural. If you start to make such huge intervention, you have to start somewhere. And those that have not started from them, they will think that there's no meaningful change. And that's the reason why some people say that they don't see the changes that we have made.
Right now, you can get the cheapest Forex rate around, right here, on Shift. Pay less for your dollars, pounds and euros here, and get to shop more here, and do more here, and enjoy more ooh-la-la here. Shift also lets you trade and transfer currencies, and buy shares in the world's best companies. It all happens right here, on Shift. You won't find a cheaper Forex rate anywhere else, no matter where you bank. Download the Shift app today.
On the international side, there's been so much talk about South Africa's relationship with the US. You can't have missed it in the headlines, especially after those new 30% tariffs were introduced on the 1st of August. And even though South Africa hasn't had an ambassador in Washington since March, International Relations Minister Ronald Lamola says it hasn't hurt South Africa's negotiating power. And he further goes on to say that South Africa is apparently really close to naming a new ambassador for the US. He confirmed that the president will make the call as per the constitution, and we'll get to hear the decision soon.
Let me preface it by saying that we had an ambassador in the US, and that ambassador was expelled. So President Ramaphosa has always prioritized the U.S. In terms of an ambassadorial responsibility. So the fact that our ambassador was expelled means that the new process to appoint the ambassador will not be as easy as it would have been when an ambassador would have not been expelled. We have to take all careful consideration, all due diligence, and I can confirm that that process is at an advanced stage. And the president at the right time will announce who will become the ambassador of South Africa in the U.S. I must also hasten to mention that while ambassadors do play a role to point to the key players, decision makers, and so forth, ambassadors do not negotiate any trade deals. The trade deal is being negotiated under the leadership of DTIC, obviously with our coordination and support from DERCO. So they are the people negotiating the trade deal. It's not our ambassador in Washington. We do have a a child affair in Washington, who is the senior person for South Africa there. who does play a role from time to time to point there and there, but they do not negotiate the trade deal as it is being suggested in some quarters, that the fact that we don't have an ambassador might have affected us not coming up with an agreement. It's not correct description. There are countries that do have ambassadors in Washington. They don't have a trade deal. So the trade deal is negotiated by the relevant line function department, and in this instance in South Africa is the Department of Trade and Industry.
Political commentator Papano Pasha, who helped shape the MKP's election strategy after leaving the ANC, but never actually joined the MKP, didn't hold back in her recent chat with BizNews' Chris Steyn. She's been super outspoken about Gate McKenzie and the Patriotic Lions, pointing out what she sees as some big flaws in their politics and specifically in Gaten's leadership. If you're into political analysis, that full interview is up on BizNews.
Well, interestingly, look at the people who, you know, support the Patriotic Alliance. It's Jorob Herzog, but also it's people who align with the cause of Israeli. So now the Patriotic Alliance has become an alternative. But what does the Patriotic Alliance really stand for, you know, from a policy perspective? This is a party whose leader just goes out there and says mabahambe, meaning that let them go. This is a leader, you know, whose claim to fame is by patronizing and antagonizing Africans without putting forward any substantive policy issue. And we know the history of Gaten, we know where he comes from, and we also know that it's primarily the colored community that has vacillated towards the Patriotic Alliance. There's no, I would say there's no smart person, including in the colored community, who would support the Patriotic Alliance, because they know that they manipulate the issue of race. They also know that they also, you know, manipulate the issue of porous borders, even though that we know that they work with Zimbabweans. They also work with some of the people from the continent. So what they do is they speak to the issues that anger, you know, our people. But in particular, the colored question, which for me, the ANC has really done a disfavor, because we know that the colored community was instrumental in the liberation of our country. And we also know that the DA had an opportunity, you know, to ensure that it's able to bring in the colored community, you know, position them as leaders, but also to be seen in the Western Cape, you know, to be instigating change, to be seen to really be dealing with the issues of drugs, to be dealing with the issues of violence, you know, including protecting young boys within the colored community. And it has not been seen. The likelihood is that it might be done, but it's not seen. So for me, these are the gaps. That's where the Patriotic Alliance comes in. In a normal democracy, you know, in a seasoned democracy, you'd not have a party like the Patriotic Alliance in parliament, because it stands for nothing. But unfortunately, this is where we are. Our politics are mediocre. We are led by the West in society, professionals, academics, you know, and business people, you know, patriotic, you know, the patriotic intelligentsia has taken a backseat and allowed this type of people to lead our country. Look at where our country is, you know, look at our, you know, our economic trajectory. Look at where we are in the continent. We have been overtaken by many countries. We do not have any clue what we are doing from an economic perspective. We now, even we hear ANC leaders saying that because Trump has put a 30% tariff, they're going to also retaliate, you know? So you are being led really by what Karl Marx would call lumpens. But unfortunately, they've got the capacity to lead. They are being funded, and which is quite unfortunate, also by a business, big business in particular, white capital. So for me also, at the center of this, with the problems within the black community and the problems of leadership, at the same time, what is instrumental is the very fact that white capital is the one, you know, that exacerbates the problem, because they're the ones who fund these parties. I mean, for me, it's an indictment that the Jewish community would want to fund Gayton, that they would even invite someone like Gayton, who is so hostile to their events, and they would see him as, you know, a savior, that they would see someone like Collins Makubela just because they feel threatened. So it shows you that we really have a problem of competency, of really identifying competent people and moving from a perspective of questioning ourselves on whether we are ready to govern, you know, to start being a meritocratic country which elevates its best. And there are many people, black, white, Indian, colored, who've gone to school, who are ideologically sober, who can lead. But look at the people who are leading us.
Cody from Paul has sold multiple vehicles to We Buy Cars. Suspicious?
I think so.
Is that a crime?
No. Where are you getting the cars?
I buy them and I sell them at the spot like a normal person.
Okay.
No, man, I'm just an accounting student. I know a good deal when I see one.
That's Excel. Meant. What's more stressful, tax season or selling a car at We Buy Cars?
Tax season, obviously.
We Buy Cars, the easiest way to sell your car by far.
At Sun Exchange, we make going solar simple, profitable, and completely risk-free. Join over 100 satisfied South African customers already enjoying the benefits of risk-free solar. Start saving today. Visit sunexchange.com and join the solar revolution.
Switching gears to business, Uber's latest numbers were actually better than expected, but their stock still took a dip. And even though their bookings were up, investors didn't seem too impressed and shares lost some of their earlier gains. Our Bloomberg colleagues have more detail.
First of all, Lyft is a distant second player. And so in terms of scale, it is at a disadvantage versus Uber. Uber is much more global. They have delivery as well as ride sharing. Lyft is predominantly ride-sharing, and it's not as global. Now with its Free Now acquisition, it's increasingly more global, but not as much as Uber is. And so there are these flywheel effects that has allowed Uber to be that much bigger than Lyft is. And so as a distant set number two player, there are these disadvantages that come with it. And we are starting to see that in terms of share loss in markets, especially where there are autonomous vehicles, where Lyft arguably may be losing a little bit more share than Uber. So that is underpinning our peer perform rating with Lyft and outperform for Uber.
On Uber, where do you think the negative sentiment is coming from here or from investors? And what else did they need to see?
Well, a couple of things here. I mean, at a high level, fundamentally, they had a very good print. When we think about the delivery business growth, the beat in the profitability of the delivery business, and even mobility business at this scale, it's growing at in the high teens percentage range when we look at the bookings growth, and they are guiding to very similar trends through the rest of the year. The reason why maybe there's a slight pullback in shares are, I guess, two things. One, there were no headlines around Waymo partnership for their autonomous business. And as we know, Waymo already partnered with Avis in Dallas without an Uber partnership. So there was some expectation that Uber would announce a partnership with Waymo in newer markets. And second, and we may see that, it just hasn't happened yet. And second is around their ride-sharing business, that as pricing moderates, perhaps we could see some deceleration in total bookings growth. Our pushback to that is that they're showing higher quality growth. Trips growth is actually accelerating in the U.S., and they're showing about 19% trips growth, which arguably is higher quality than just looking at pricing versus trips.
And President Trump is narrowing down his picks for the next Federal Reserve chair. He's got four names on his list, including Kevin Warsh and Kevin Hassett. We'll see who he goes with when Jerome Powell's term ends in May.
The process is going to take a while because the person who goes to that seat is going to have to be confirmed by the Senate. And as we know, you've got to fill out a lot of paperwork, and then you've got to go through the hearing process. You make your rounds on Capitol Hill, shaking hands and making nice with senators. And if you get through the banking committee, then you go on to the Senate floor, which is pretty crowded with a lot of nominations these days. So nothing's a slam dunk at this point, which maybe means that for the moment, until we know who it's going to be, you should pay attention to what other Fed officials are saying about the possibility of a rate cut in September. We have several speaking this week, including Mary Daly today, and she is the one person that seems to have flipped her view, saying she's out of patience and she thinks maybe it's time to start cutting rates. We've also got Rafael Bostic tomorrow, and he has been the strongest, perhaps, in saying only one rate cut this year. Does he change his mind? Heading to the question, though, of who becomes the Fed chair. There are three candidates we know about at this point. The Kevins, as the president calls them, and Chris Waller, who's on the Fed board now, would not have to be nominated to the Fed board, but would have to be nominated to be chair. And then there's the mystery guest, because the president said there are four candidates, but he took Scott Bessent out of it. You can read all through the newspapers and wire services and stuff this morning and read a lot of different speculation on names. The question for the president, though, is how does he do this? And that's the biggest and most fascinating issue for me and for people on Wall Street. He could name his new chair in waiting to the Kugler seat, but then you end up with that shadow Fed chair issue. Who does the market listen to? Does it cause dissension on the Fed? He could name a replacement governor for Kugler, somebody who would just serve for a couple of months. But if Powell stays, it may be his only chance to name somebody to the seat. He could name a replacement now and choose a chair later. But then you get that apprentice scenario of maybe Warsh or Hassett and Bowman and Waller all auditioning for the job while they're trying to carry out monetary policy until the president makes a decision. So it could be very interesting.
That brings us to the end of today's BizNews Briefing. Thanks, as always, for watching. We'll be back on Monday with more context on the local and global front. Enjoy your weekend.